Hello, my name is Chip Lang, and you are listening to Total EM. For this podcast, we are talking about the Schottky-D trial and, in a larger sense, about using POCUS in shock and hypotension. This was something that was covered quite a bit when the article first came out, and it was something I debated talking about at the time, but I'm kind of glad I didn't because it's now given a little bit of spaced repetition for those who have listened to other sources. If you have not heard anything about this before, this is a great time to talk about it anyway. And also, I wanted to add a few things just in general about the different types of exams used in hypotension and shock states. We see a lot of these types of patients every day in the emergency department. And as a result, I was asked by some colleagues to go ahead and talk about this a little more in detail, which is why I revisited this today. So when we have heard about the Schottky-D trial before, it's kind of interesting because at first glance, you would say, oh, this is a negative trial, and we can't really say anything about the benefits of it. But really, I think this is a little more complex in that we need to talk about it a little bit more. But let's not get ahead of ourselves. Let's talk about first some of the previous evidence and research that's out there. So one big one is Sazmez et al. This is a paper published in Emergency Medicine International in 2016. I like this because it talks about the effects of ultrasonography on the decision-making and management of hypotensive patients. What they found was that it actually changed management quite often. So originally, the initial diagnostic accuracy in patients was 60.6% before POCUS, and after POCUS, it was 85%. A huge change, basically a number needed to treat of just 4 to be able to change management. Furthermore, it's a number needed to treat of 2 to actually change the management. So 25% change in diagnosis, 50% change in management. And these two numbers are numbers we need to keep in the back of our mind because this helps show the benefits of it. Furthermore, we can also think about some of the important roles of ultrasound for differentiating different types of hypotension, such as cardiac dysfunction or aortic aneurysm, severe dehydration, pulmonary embolism, pneumothorax. All these types of things get covered. So Seif et al. In 2012 published a nice review of the different types of exams that exist out there. And there's a whole list of them. I've included them in the show notes, which I would highly encourage you to look at as well. But basically, you know, we think about ACEs is one that's commonly seen. Falls is another one. There is RUSH, but there's two versions of RUSH. There's HIMAP, and then there's the pump tank pipes approach. These are kind of subtle in their differences in some ways, but not so much in others. Really, probably the most diverse of them that we should regularly use is the RUSH pump tank pipes approach. The only thing it really leaves out is evaluation for ectopic pregnancy, but honestly, this is something that you're going to kind of get from a couple of different measures at the same time, including when you do your suprapubic view. I'm kind of looking for signs of ectopic pregnancy anyway. So this is one that really is probably the most complete, in which case is why I'm discussing this a little bit more. There are two additional tables to look at on the website that go through this that talk about the RUSH protocol summary as well as the RUSH protocol in the stepwise approach to diagnosing the type of shock. So basically, to summarize very quickly, there are 4 main types of shock: hypovolemic, cardiogenic, obstructive, and distributive. When we're looking at the pump, tank, and pipes, we're helping differentiate these to get to what we're looking for. So let's take, for example, hypovolemic shock. Okay, if we have a hypercontractile heart with small heart size, a flat IVC, and we are looking at basically really nothing that's showing a good reason, okay, they're probably hypovolemic. Add on a AAA or a dissection, and now we can see on the pipe side where, hey, this is probably a hemorrhagic cause of hypovolemic shock because of the rupture or dissection. Then we can take an example of cardiogenic shock. So we've got heart that's barely moving. You know, it's got a dilated heart. The IVC is distended. There's big pleural effusions and B lines and everything else. Okay, this is someone whose heart's giving out, everything's backing up. Okay, that helps us tell a little bit more. then we may see in some ways helping us differentiate from obstructive shock, where we see a pericardial effusion, maybe we see RV dilation, maybe we even catch a DVT on the pipes exam, but really on the tank side, we're seeing the IVC being dilated, and we may even see absent lung sliding. It kind of depends. But then finally, we can look at distributive shock. In early sepsis, the heart's beating away really hard. In later sepsis, it's hypodynamic, you know, it's hypocontractile. You may have a normal or small IVC, and basically, you may sometimes see collections of fluid that may help point towards infection. But not always, you know, sometimes we may be able to see that pleural effusion, which again can sometimes cause that cardiogenic shock as well. This is just part of the bigger picture. But distributive shock doesn't have very specific findings. With the others we talked about, you can see some things to help narrow this in. So that's why when we're looking at this, we do a stepwise approach. We're looking for different things, different steps, and trying to get the picture all together. Okay, so now that we've talked about the general approach and findings for this exam, what about this newest trial? What does it mean for us? Well, quite simply, the SHOCK-ED trial was nice because what I was looking for were very patient-oriented outcomes, the most important of which was the primary outcome, was 30-day survival or survival to hospital discharge. Okay, pretty easy. That's yes, no answer. That's something that's not going to be tied up in the mix. We can look at that cleanly. Okay, and patients were randomized to either the POCUS arm in which they received ultrasound within the first 60 minutes or the no POCUS arm. The exam type, this is where things start getting a little bit interesting. So their exam was essentially the HIMAP version of the RUSH exam plus looking for pleural effusion, which, yes, they said is a mixture of ACEs and RUSH, but realistically, it's the HIMAP exam plus pleural effusion. That's what they're looking for. And that's not bad, but I think with this exam, there are significant limitations because we're not seeing as much with venous thromboembolism, and we're not necessarily looking at some of the other things, such as, again, the ectopics and stuff like that. But part of that is because also how they dealt with their population. So they chose patients 19 and older with a sustained systolic blood pressure of less than 100, but they don't actually specify what sustained means. So I don't know if this is, we did two blood pressures and roll in the systolic is less than 100, or if it's over a series of minutes, and if so, how long. The other option was for a shock index of greater than one with a systolic blood pressure less than 120. So for that example, that would be if you had a systolic blood pressure of 110 and at least a heart rate of 110 or higher. So with those patients, that's what we include. However, they exclude patients who are pregnant, so potentially the ectopic pregnancy population, those who required CPR, ACLS interventions. Understand why, because these are patients where you're wanting to look at the heart, look for underlying causes. This is kind of your H's and T's moment where they want to exclude those patients. At least I assume that is the case. Significant trauma in the past 24 hours, thinking about like doing an EFAS exam, and then diagnostic EKG for acute myocardial infarction. This is also beneficial, but we'll talk about the role there. But basically, this is a little bit different. Those who are transferred from the outside, basically because they may already have a diagnosis or already have a significant amount of management, vasovagal syncope, I think that one's pretty kind of explanatory, as well as the normal hypotension, because those are usually more benign causes of hypotension. And then the other one I find interesting was if there was an obvious cause for the hypotension, they were excluded. So the results, this is the thing that kind of triggers me a little bit, because the most common category was non-cardiogenic shock, which is kind of broad, but it was at 87.6%. And the most common diagnosis was sepsis with 52% of the entire population. Pretty heavy on the sepsis side. So this undifferentiated shock, it helps point to me that, okay, quite a few people who are shocky are actually probably the same people who are septic. So what did they find on the 30-day survival? Well, those who had POCUS had a 76.5% survival, and those in the standard care had a 76.1% survival. There was no difference in the secondary outcomes measured, including the rates of CT scanning, inotrope use, intravenous fluids, ICU admissions, or total length of stay. So let's talk about the strengths first. I do like that the study was clinically oriented for patient-important outcomes. And I think that's something that we cannot ignore. This is a good study for that. It was multi-centered. It was even international, South Africa and North America. It had competency standards that were compared. Basically, what they did was they took people from the one country, go to the other region, and basically make sure that, okay, we're all on the same page. We're all doing this the same way. Good. I can agree with that. Very few patients were lost to follow-up. There was pretty good allocation concealment, and there was independent and blinded chart review was performed with baseline demographics being the same as well as the vital signs between the two groups. All right, those are my good things. Those are the things I like to see, and I find those to truly be strengths, but let's talk about the limitations, and this is, well, a little more extensive. So I want to hit on something I only briefly mentioned. There is a specific point, and it talks about clear cause of shock as an exclusion criteria, but I want to know what that actually means. And furthermore, what I'd like to know is, how is this based on whose observation did we decide that this was a clear cause? Was this someone who was a junior level resident, or are we talking about attendings? Which the way the paper reads, I believe this is attendings. And I think that's important because the experience wise could be different. Furthermore, the other thing that hits me with this is, okay, how many times would POCUS have changed the diagnosis when we initially thought it was clear cause? So you excluded them, and then later they had the POCUS examination, and then found, oh, wait, this is actually something entirely different. That would have been nice to know, as well as that clear cause ended up not being that thing altogether, or are those the same patients, which we kind of talked about a little bit at the beginning, like the ectopic pregnancies, the traumas and stuff like that, where those are the patients that really help derive and help direct the care that we need for those patients. That's something that I think was very important. The other thing was the exclusion criteria of pregnancy or EKG findings. Well, sometimes we're not getting those tests right away. In fact, a lot of times there's a delay in getting a pregnancy test. If you work in quite a few shops, I think you'll find there's a delay in getting the EKG. Will the ultrasound help prioritize those patients and say, hey, I've got some free fluid in the pelvis. She's young. She doesn't know when her last period was. All right, I'm worried about ectopic, and totally change direction on that. Or if we have a delay in the EKG, this was a syncopal event, they remain hypotensive. Next thing you know, we're looking at it and we see some wall motion abnormality. We don't have the EKG yet, but now MI is getting further and further up the differential. I think these are things we have to seriously remember when we're talking about the limitations of the study. Because POCUS, again, can provide a role in all of these scenarios. And yes, you could say, okay, well, that's something that was already implied or already in. Yes, but I don't find that as clean. The other big thing to think about, kind of tying directly in with this, are the patients with sepsis. Okay, we just talked about how there's really no great POCUS findings that specifically point towards sepsis. It's a whole thing about history and physical, and then some of the findings that we can see on ultrasound that helps direct us towards that. But there's not one specific test where you look at someone and say they're septic, especially when we're talking about POCUS. And so I think this is a big limitation of this, because with such a large population being from this cause, we really don't know if we took out those patients or if we had a different way of working these patients up on additional exams that we wouldn't do as part of this particular protocol, that maybe we could find some more stuff that would be beneficial, that would show the difference. But that's beside the point for the moment, because they're in there. We've got this. Okay. The other things you have to think about is that really, of the patients that were left in the trial, very few had things that POCUS would be great for, especially for what they were specifically doing on these exams. So only 2 patients had aortic dissection, 7 patients had venous thromboembolism, 22 patients had LV dysfunction or MI, and then 2 patients had cardiac effusion or tamponade. So this is a very small number of the patients that we're looking at in total. And additionally, there was no evaluation about those performing POCUS as far as how they were doing it. Were they seeing things correctly? Could they be potentially missing diagnoses in this as well? There's no algorithm that they specify. So it's not, you're going to do these exams, you're looking for these things, and if you find this, this is what you need to do with it. There's no process like that in place. So that is, I think, a pretty significant limitation because we don't know how standardized this all truly was. Additionally, the scans could be done at 60 minutes. So if you have incorrect initial management, and we know, as we were talking about earlier, that 50% of the time when we see something on POCUS, it can change our management. Well, if that's the case, then how many patients are being incorrectly managed before the POCUS was performed and the patients that did receive it? And how much of that plays an impact in that 30-day mortality? Because realistically, POCUS is not, it's not correct for us to go ahead and assume that mortality should be our role, because POCUS is diagnostic. It's not therapeutic. Yes, it can change management significantly, but in a patient population like this, where there is already a very high diagnostic accuracy rate in the regular clinical group, this is something where we're probably not going to find as many changes in management. And so I think this is a cognitive fallacy, given that we're focusing on a therapeutic outcome, the mortality, versus a diagnostic outcome like you would expect with POCUS. Furthermore, the study itself is limited because they never got near the 400 patients that they need to recruit because they stopped the trial early. And the 80% power needed to find a reduction in mortality of 10% with a 30% mortality in the control group wasn't there because they never got to the 30% mortality in the control group. And that 10% mortality is a pretty big difference. Maybe a smaller difference of 5% reduction in mortality could have been helpful, because I would find that clinically important if I need to do 20 exams and a number need to treat of 20 to get a 5% reduction in mortality for this very sick population. Yeah, that'd be beneficial too. But again, I think we need to recognize that this should not have been a therapeutic study in the role of mortality being the change versus that diagnostic accuracy, which has been done before. But because the way the study was designed, I'm working with the parameters that we have, and I think it's something that we at least need to keep in the back of our minds as another potential limitation for the study. It's worth noting that Paul Atkinson, the lead author, actually was on the on a couple of different blog sites, and I looked at their blog sites too to make sure I wasn't doing too much overlapping, but RebelEM and The Bottom Line are two of the big ones, and they published right away, and they've got great information. Definitely check their stuff out too, but you'll find that we all hit slightly different points. But Paul Atkinson specifically mentioned a lot of the things that I have already talked about, partly because I was reading his commentary and saw it. But I think we need to realize that because the diagnostic accuracy was so much higher in this trial compared to previous studies, that plays an important role because it is less likely to change management if the clinical group was getting it right so often. That's the control group. And that the other thing is too, there are many of the limitations like we were just talking about, but they were still advocates for POCUS in the end. They recognized the limitations. They encouraged the strengths of the study. And they still encourage the use of POCUS for answering specific questions, which I think is something that we all agree. So what does this mean for me? What am I going to do with this? Well, probably really nothing's going to change in my management. It's just good to know these numbers and know that there plays a role for using ultrasound in your hypotensive patients. So I still want the ultrasound early to help evaluate these patients, but I recognize that in certain patient populations, especially those with occult sepsis, this probably isn't really going to be the big impact versus some of the other patients who come in with different physiology or pathology. So let me know what you think about this. And I want you to share this podcast as much as possible. If you stuck it out to the end, also, I have something else I wanted to mention. Very soon, we're going to be opening registration for Critical Access 2019. I don't want to give too many details yet because I'm still working out some of the information, some of the process. But basically, if you are interested in taking this course, if you're interested in learning more about ultrasound, including the Rush exam, if you have your own pocket ultrasound device or want a pocket ultrasound device, come to us. Let us know, because we are going to have a course where we're going to use a lot of pocket ultrasound. We're going to be practicing nonstop. You're going to learn lots of material, and we're going to do it in a fun place. We're going to do it at Ozark Outdoors, which is in rural Missouri, where there are fun activities all over the place, both on and off of the property. And it's just a great time. We want to make sure that this is a family-friendly experience for those who want to bring family or colleagues or friends or whoever. And we are really going to hit this hard. So if you are interested, you want to learn more about ultrasound, you want to be able to do more, maybe you want to practice specifically with a pocket ultrasound machine, whether you have one or whether you want to buy one for the course, that's all up to you. But if you want this, then you need to do one of two things. One is you need to go to the Total EM website because you heard it from here, and I will make sure to let you all know when registration's open for this, or go straight to Practical Pocus. And anytime there's a new course, anything there's going to be new going on, we'll let you know there too. But until next time, continue to provide total care everywhere.